Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome into day two of the AME Roundup podcast, bringing you the big conversations of the day here out of Vancouver. And it was a big day. The numbers of registrants is really great. 6,081 registrants as of right now. That surpasses last year's number. So just an incredibly great job of welcoming everybody into Vancouver for this conference, and really congratulations to everybody that made it happen. And we're not done, because there's a couple more days left of Roundup. So we're going to get things going. This podcast series from the exhibit floor of Roundup is brought to you by Newmont, creating value and improving lives through sustainable and responsible mining. So thank you to Newmont for that support. Today we've got another two-part interview. I first connect with Peter Grosskopf, CEO of SCP Resource Finance. Great conversation. He gave the keynote earlier today, and so we kind of wrapped up some of those themes that he was discussing. And then we welcome in journalist from the Northern Miner, our friend Mr. Henry Lazenby. He has some things to say regarding that critical minerals agenda that was published yesterday, and some thoughts and themes he's been picking up from the conference the last 2 days. So great insights from Henry. So let's just jump into it. Here's my conversation with Peter right away. All right, we're kicking off our day two Roundup podcast here from the conference with Association for Mineral Exploration in British Columbia. It's a real pleasure to welcome in Peter Grosskopf. He is the guy at SCP Resource Finance, and a lot of people remember him over at Sprott. Peter, pleasure to have you on. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Trevor.
Yeah, you provided the keynote presentation today. And it's I've heard rumors that it was pretty riveting. It was kind of a call to action for exploration and mining. Maybe kind of, if you can kind of wrap this up and, you know, put a bow on it, what was your message today?
Well, I started with a slide of the alternative finance providers to the sector, the royalty companies and those that manage money for institutions. And it's a straight line bar graph going up and to the right. So I said, if these guys are doing it right, then why did mining have such a bad year last year in the capital markets? Mineral prices were pretty good. Gold hit a record and was up 12%. And I talked about the reasons for that. The funds themselves, the sector funds, are fractions of what they were 15 years ago. There's no swashbuckling star managers like there used to be that would take risks in junior companies. All of these asset managers are now guided by the regulators to be liquid all the time. So they simply can't buy junior mining stocks. And then I talked about the upside from that, and that is there's a whole bunch of new channels that I think companies need to be adept at going after to get an investor audience. So
we've talked about the underinvestment in resource development for many years. Ever since I've been recording this podcast, it's been a theme that keeps coming up. And I mean, is it cyclical? Do you see a historical cyclicality to this at all?
Well, the whole business is cyclical. Mineral prices are cyclical. I think that what's happened in the capital markets is not cyclical. I think that is just a function of how big asset management is now and what hurdles they have to investing. It's just changed. So companies need to adapt to that and to explore these new channels. And there's lots of them.
Can you give us an example of what new channels are top of mind?
So I talked in the speech today about corporate access, which for larger companies has become a professional way to go directly to institutions. And that's a part of the sector that's increasing quickly. I talked about doing their own podcasts and education and reaching out to retail investors who, you know, have a large do-it-yourself component now directly. I talked about the newsletter channels, who I think are increasingly sophisticated and have a broad audience now. Yeah. I talked about marketing to senior companies. Senior companies are putting out money to juniors, and yeah. they're being much more aggressive about it. I mentioned BHP had a corporate development department of over 100 people. Yeah. I mean, and lots of money to invest. So how do you get those relationships? They don't come quickly. It takes a while. So
yeah.
put effort into building those channels, and that's a good way to start to offset the institutions until you wait for them to come to their senses and start investing in the sector again.
Yeah, we did see quite a bit of that in 2022, 2023, despite the volatility in the Canadian markets. We did see the major producers start making moves because they're capable and they have to think really long term, you know, 30, mm-hmm. 40 years down the road. I mean, you know, is that type of capital flow going to slow down, or do you think it might actually speed up here?
Well, I think it's going to increase because the majors have great platforms and they're in a great business. Margins have almost never been higher. And although they have to put a lot of that capital back into the ground, they know that it can be easier to do that by investing in development companies than doing it themselves. So
yeah.
I think that, and they're in fabulous shape from a balance sheet perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And they do have institutional capital, so there's no impediment to their growth. And I think those platforms will keep growing.
Yeah. What are they looking for, though? I mean, those tier one assets are hard to come by. There's very few of them out there in those kind of development stage types. And so are those major companies, are they willing to maybe go down the food chain? If the tier ones, maybe that CapEx is a little too high, are they willing to kind of come down and look at down the food chain there, those projects?
I see them primarily being interested in mine life. And then, and then secondly, long-term margins. But they're getting more flexible on their minerals. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the majors are producing in new sectors, for instance, a lot of gold companies are adding more copper now.
Yes.
So I see them as just overall being very aggressive on the development side.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because in the back of my mind, I've had this question about gold companies moving into the copper space. Is that a risk for those historically gold producers to move into a different base metal, you know, type of play there?
So copper is a particularly good one because it is a liquid commodity that mm-hmm. can be marketed fairly easily. And what the gold companies get from that is mine life, because a lot of the copper deposits are longer term deposits and larger in tonnage size than gold. I don't think it's a mining risk. Is it a risk that they become too economically sensitive on the output side? But I think they're all watching that. They're watching their mix. So mm-hmm. I think they're very cognizant of keeping a precious metal optionality.
Okay. You also mentioned in your keynote the relationship between industry and government. And obviously, you can't have one without the other, especially in resource development. What are you seeing as far as those relationships? That sometimes it seems like they're working hand in hand. Other times it looks like they're working against each other anymore.
I think that governments need to support mining more generally. Mm-hmm. And in some countries, we've seen wonderful examples of how that's happening. For instance, Australia. And other countries are just behind the eight ball, like Canada, unfortunately. So I take some heart in seeing the provinces here with their mining departments, because they clearly care. But things just take too long, and there's not enough government support from an economic perspective, considering how much the mining companies are putting back into the environment, back into the First Nations, and back into the communities they operate in. So I think we need to see a lot more support going forward.
What does support improvement in that support look like? We've seen a couple deals here in BC. We've talked about a couple times today, actually, about First Nations taking ownership equity positions into these companies.
Yep.
Is that a great place to start?
Well, for the government itself, for the First Nations, absolutely, because they're economic players in their own development, so that makes sense. For governments, I think, quicker timelines, you know, where these have been dragged out over sometimes 5 to 10 years. You know, why can't you put more people on it to study it if the study is there? And I think the second thing is tax breaks. You know, we've been slow to put critical minerals super flow through in place. It is happening, but I think we need to see more of that. And in the U.S., they've got that Inflation Reduction Act, which is really putting substantial money on the table. We need to see something similar in Canada.
I call it the Inflation Addition Act.
Okay. Well, either way, my own betting is inflation will continue.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about that, because obviously the macro backdrop here is quite fascinating. Everybody's trying to make sense of it. I mean, I guess the way the market is looking, like if nothing makes sense, just buy the Magnificent Seven and your day is going to be fine. But it comes with a cost, and I know there's, you have some thoughts on precious metals and gold. We talked before we press record, we had a nice conversation with your friend John Hathaway last week about his position with precious metals. Give us a sense of how you are approaching gold in 2024.
Well, you touched upon one of the major factors, which is that the stock market seems to be in love with about 9 companies, and they're driving the entire market higher. And when people are complacent, they don't really feel the need to hold gold. The second thing is that everything has become so central bank related, because central banks are pulling the levers on cap rates, on interest rates, and you know, you never want to bet against that. But on the other side of the table, you've got a gigantic factor, which is that government deficits and debt are completely out of control, and there's only one way for them to fix that in the long run. That's to inflate their way out of it. So no matter what they say about 2% inflation targets, and no matter what they say about tightening, it's not going to happen. So I think that hard assets have become a mandatory part of investors' portfolios. I think they're being added weekly, monthly. You saw central banks are now the biggest buyer of gold in the market. That's not going to change. I think 2024 is clearly setting itself up for, with any crack in the market, with any worry, gold will hit a new record. So I think it'll happen at some point during the year. I would be shocked if we didn't exit 2024 with a new record high gold price.
Catalyst for that? Geopolitical?
I don't like to bet on geopolitical events because they're intrinsically impossible to forecast. I think it's going to come from some kind of worry factor over the U.S. deficit, which and debt level, which will probably hit something like $37 trillion this year.
Yeah.
Where everybody starts to say, hold on a second here. Me worry is going to turn into, hold on. I need some safety here.
Yeah.
So how do I get that?
What about supply of debt that's expected to come online in 2024 through
it's a factor. I mean, the auctions were first really sloppy. They've been better lately. But the fact is, it's going to just keep coming. So when do they potentially lose a little bit of control over the long rate? I think it's already happening.
Would that affect the gold equities? Because we've seen a lot of, we've seen gold up here above $2,000, but yet the gold equities have been valued in the sink anymore. Do we reach a point to where people are finally seeing this gold price rise and like, well, I can leverage some of my investment through these gold equities? I mean, will the follow through?
Yeah, I think gold equities have been working against one big hangover factor, which is pressure on cost. They've had to chew through that and sort of reconfigure so that they can make adequate amounts of free cash flow with gold at 1900 or 2000. It sounds silly to say because they should be at record levels of profitability, but they've just had to put so much more money into their operations. So I think this next $100 on the gold price will light up the sector because it'll give them their margin back. And with the coast clear on gold itself, money will move into the producers.
We'll end it on that one because that's a good
Sounds
one.
Good. Okay.
All right. Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you for your time.
Yeah, enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks for doing the keynote, and hopefully we can have you back on the podcast another time.
Sounds good.
We are concluding day two here with a fellow journalist from the Northern Miner, Mr. Henry Lazenby. I think the last time we did this was last year.
Exactly a year ago.
It's good to see you.
Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you back. Your work is always thorough and you just do a really good job. There's not too many people in this industry that can write and communicate and break ideas down to a level where everybody can understand. You do it. You're just doing an excellent job, Henry.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into it. It's been 2 days here at Roundup. Yesterday, the British Columbia government published their Phase 1 agenda for critical minerals, and you had some thoughts on that. In fact, you've got your latest article is based on that. So maybe your analysis of what you learned and saw, and how it affects industry.
Yes, yeah, certainly. I was very encouraged yesterday to learn about Premier David Eby's announcement about this first phase of the critical minerals strategy. It should be said from the outset that BC is almost a little bit late to the party. Manitoba, Ontario, and Quebec has already outlined their strategies some time ago, as well as the federal government, right?
Yeah.
They've appropriated more than $3 billion in the 2022 budget for their critical mineral strategy. So it's a good first step. I hear from this AME Roundup exhibition hall floor, several miners and investors I've spoken to have told me that it's a great first step, but maybe a little bit light on action items.
Mm.
Now that besides the 11 action points that the plan does outline, the commentary I've received, for instance, from AMEBC's President Kira Jutla, as well as the Mining Association of BC's President Michael Goering, saying that the key thing that the government is missing right now seems to be the lack of a competitive fiscal regulatory environment, meaning the companies that are producing metals and commodities are being taxed to the hilt. And there's no escaping that for them when they are price takers in a global market.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, does industry have a solution, or like, what kind of feedback have they, would they like to see of this whole agenda?
Yeah, what they're saying is they're all really waiting with bated breath as to what the bigger plan would really entail. Would there be really hard cash connected to these plans, the creation of a new concierge service to help explorers stake ground, all of that, really nice plans. But when you take a step back and look at the big picture, it almost feels as if it's really a lot to say we're planning to make a plan, which the industry is accepting as a great first step. But then, especially from the investment side, I'm hearing just feeling like there should have been a little bit more concrete direction as to what the plan really entails.
Yeah. Henry, if I may editorialize a little bit, we had a good conversation with the Minister of Mines, Josie Osborne, yesterday. And I tried to constructively kind of, ask her some of these tough questions, knowing a little bit more about industry and maybe how they might look at this. But as an investor myself, who has capital in this province, I looked at some of those bullet point items and constructively thought, I don't see how this mitigates some of the challenges that industry is faced with. In fact, when I see lines like create a new office of such and such and such, I kind of feel like, so there's going to be more hurdles to jump over to get these projects over the line. Did you receive any of the similar feedback?
I did indeed hear that same sentiment, and I agree. That's partly why everybody is saying, so what is the plan really? Is this going to ease my way forward or just create more hurdles, as you rightly say? I don't really see at this point what the solution is. We're all waiting with bated breath to see what the full, more fulsome plan really will entail.
Yeah.
So it's frustrating on all fronts.
Yeah, I'm also really surprised, knowing that resource development is such an economic staple for the province, how British Columbia, as you mentioned in your opening statement, is late to the game here. Not only maybe a little bit late compared to the other territories and provinces in the country, but also it seems like the least amount of money allocated to these endeavors.
It certainly feels that way, right?
Yeah. So if you are in industry, is it just kind of keeping your head down and moving projects as best as you can, knowing that you don't know what is in front of you with
yes.
these policies?
Yeah, I think so. At this point, it certainly seems best for the industry to keep their head down and continue progressing the projects on a best practice basis, as we do want to work in any case. So that First Nations consultation happening first before we get down the line with further development in the project.
Right.
Those kind of basic steps, back to basics essentially, for the time being. Further than that, I don't really see what much else they can do than continue their strong lobbying, especially we're seeing from the Mining Association of BC. They put out a press release immediately following the Premier's announcement saying that it costs their membership up to three times more than it does in Ontario and Quebec to do the same business. And the other fact compounding the situation is that, for instance, when it comes to aluminium smelters, which exist in BC, they can't cut down on their carbon emissions any further because the technology is not mature enough to allow that economically. So they're caught in this catch-22 situation where they really cannot do anything to improve their bottom lines, right? Whereas they're facing increased hurdles from government.
Yeah, it's fascinating. There's a disconnect here. It seems like there's a disconnect. But you know what? We've seen this play out for years and years and years between how you produce goods, how you get projects from point A to that finish line, but also the expectations of the governments that oversee these jurisdictions, and maybe not fully understanding that it takes many, many steps to get there. And I know that sounds harsh, but it is very much the truth. And it's not just Canada, it's all over the world, it seems like.
Yeah. As an observer of the industry quite closely, it often comes to my mind that there feels to be a massive disconnect between what government is doing and saying and what industry is in fact asking for and is being forced to do as a result of the disconnect.
Yeah. All right. Well, not that we wanted to roast all the governments out there in this podcast, Henry, but it does provide a lot of questions to follow up, and we're going to see how this plays out. What other themes are you seeing here at Roundup? This was a big one, but that's not the only conversation we're having.
Yes, absolutely. Well, since Sunday, covering the Vancouver Resource Investment Conference, and then since Monday and today at the Roundup, I've had about 30-odd conversations, interviews with people.
Just 30?
Just 30, yeah. Well, there's two more days to go, right? And so just among some of the key points, like, for instance, Ross Beattie was hammering the point home that there's this massive disconnect still between the equity valuations in the junior exploration space, extending even up to the top tiers, and then the high commodity prices generally.
Yeah.
What he says is then the practice of naked short selling is compounding this. And I also spoke earlier this morning with Terry Lynch, who went further to say he obviously founded Save Canadian Mining to address this naked short selling scourge, can we call it. And so he was saying that since that tick test, remember the tick test is whereas you could do short selling if a stock was indeed moving up, they removed it around about 2013. And according to his estimations, the TSXV is currently trading at about 35% of the value it was back then, comparatively. And he is pointing the finger to the removal of the tick test and the allowance of naked short selling. So it's a big issue that he wants addressed. He blames that as the single most damaging event to the industry. Of course, in recent months, increased geopolitical tensions around the globe is also something we're monitoring quite closely, especially in recent weeks, South America, Central America, Panama, giving First Quantum Minerals there a very hard time. So those are like very topical things. We're hearing a lot about the mining regulatory development here in BC. I think we're in a good place when you consider how bad it is out there.
Yeah? But there's an opportunity here.
This is the opportunity.
But it includes full government support, so it's a full circle here.
Well, you heard the minister say you've got her support.
Yeah. All right, Henry. Well, I appreciate you. What else are you hearing here as far as the commodities specifically? You know, you mentioned copper, Cobre Panama coming on. You know, I've got some thoughts as an investor on the big macro scale about these things. I'm seeing, me personally, great setup for precious metals. I think mid to longer term base metals look good. I'm a little bit concerned about Chinese demand right now and the ability to really continue to move manufacturing in the West ahead. So, you know, what are you hearing on the metal side?
Yeah, on the metal side, let's start with copper, though. That's
sure,
really a hot one, right? This massive deficit is being accelerated with the taking out of Cobre Cap Panama. And so that's obviously a very hot ticket item to monitor. I think if you can get moving on some of the developers, you're going to be in a good position very soon. Only a couple of years down the road, I think you're going to see massive gains in that area. Yeah, lithium prices are down. It seems like all the equities are also faltering a little bit at this point. But I still have belief in them. I think they will rebound at some point. The emergence of the North American battery supply chain, I think, will definitely give them some, underpin some of the value that they are potentially creating there.
Yeah, yeah.
And with respect to rare earths, even. I was very interested to read yesterday Geoscience BC's little study that they put out about rare earths being extracted from latent coal mining operations in the province. And you know, BC doesn't want to admit that it produces coal, right? And certainly no thermal coal at that. So that's certainly a new kind of avenue where technology can open doors, whereas we would have thought it's a sunset industry when it comes to coal mining.
Yeah, yeah, all right.
So, yeah, many moving parts to commodities. I'm not a sage, so I'll leave it at that.
Oh, come on, Henry. All right, but you're an excellent writer. Love your work. Keep up the good work. You can follow all of Henry's writings at The Northern Miner. Thanks for doing this, my friend. It's good to catch up with you once again.
Hope it was useful. Thanks for having me, Trevor.